The following program contains the opinions of the host, guests, and call-in participants. These do not necessarily represent the views of this show's distributors or sponsors. This program may contain obscene, profane, or otherwise objectionable language. Viewer discretion is advised. Yes, coming to you cordless, everybody. It's 11:02 p.m. in Manchester, New Hampshire. It's 8:02 p.m. on the west coast of the United States. 2 minutes after 2 p.m. in the afternoon in Sydney, Australia. They don't vote there. Not in American elections. And 10:02 p.m. here in Northeast Minneapolis. I'm Jim Peters. Welcome to another edition of Jim Peters at Night. And it's January 23rd, Tuesday, 2024. Hope you had a good weekend, long weekend for us. We did not do a show last night. I went to see my mother in southern Minnesota. It's a long drive. It's basically a day trip. So I try to see. She's 99 years old. She's 99 and a half. In July, she's going to be 100 years old. We're trying to plan a giant birthday party for her. She doesn't want anything to do with it. She's at this point, she's kind of a local celebrity, and I don't just mean that because she's old. She's been on one of the local television stations here in Minneapolis. They've done several stories on her. Matter of fact, the guy, Boyd Hooper, who does those stories, not only did he win an Emmy for one of them, he won a Murrow Award. I don't know if you know anything. That's like a national award for a story on my mother. So, you know, she's well-known, but she says, no one's going to come to my birthday party. The people are coming. Why don't they come when I'm alive? And I can't answer that question. I don't know. Any rate, if you folks have been watching the election results from New Hampshire, if you know or care, yes, Donald Trump, it appears he has been declared the winner. Right now, the last I checked, which is about 45 minutes ago, two-thirds of the votes were in roughly, and he was ahead of Nikki Haley by about 10 points. So it was not an absolute blowout, and that might change, but, you know, that's kind of what they're expecting right there, you know. So, yeah, that's what's happened. You know, people have been speculating why she won't drop out. Well, first of all, I don't blame her for dropping out now because the next primary is her home state. She should at least do that. I mean, there's a possibility she could pull off an upset there. It's her home state. She was the governor. You know, they know her down there. Beyond that, I mean, right now she's according to the polling, she's 30. Points or Trump is 30 points ahead in North Carolina. So who knows what's going to happen. Our guest tonight is Ed Morrissey, the managing editor of hotair.com. Now we have Jazz Shaw and David Strom from Hot Air. They are both, let me see, respectively, the weekend editor and the associate editor of hotair.com. We have them on their regular guests on the show. But we had just had Jazz was on two weeks ago and David Strom was on last week. We book them about every 6 weeks or so just to check up on what they're doing. First time Ed's been on, though. So we talked about him, and we pre-taped this in the afternoon, and he does talk about why the various reasons she doesn't want to drop out. But I noticed something today. I'm watching her quote-unquote concession speech, which wasn't much of a concession speech. She did acknowledge that Trump won. She did do that. She didn't say anything nasty about him and none of that. She said he deserved to win. She said that. I'm starting to think, I'm looking at this woman through the television screen, and I've been around performers all my life, and I'm starting to think that one of the reasons she's doing this is not a good reason, but she might be becoming addicted to the attention. I'm looking at her talk, and I'm starting to think, I've seen this before, man. You know, and people don't want to give it up. You know, they just don't. You know, it's like, if you know, you hear about this all the time, but it's really true. There's people, you know, have never been in front of a television camera or a crowd or an audience ever, and they do it, and they really, really like it, and they won't get off the stage. I mean, I've seen this many, many times, and I'm starting to wonder if that has is that if that's playing into what's going on there. Now, I'm watching Hegseth, Pete Hegseth on Fox Nation, mostly because I wanted to see how they did the streaming thing. They actually ran, they're running live coverage tonight. So they're streaming on Fox Nation, which they do that, but it's not, of course, it's mostly an on-demand service. But someone on that panel was talking about the fact that, what were they talking about? God, I think I got to start taking the Prevagen, man. It's like, what the hell, Jim? Come on. It's like, Jesus, what were they talking about that made me think of this? Oh, man, it's just so embarrassing. It's like, God almighty, I'm just going to go on here. What the hell? Oh, someone should bring me out in the back, take me to the backyard and just shoot me, put me down. Okay, so our show tonight is sponsored by Conk News at conk.com, and here's the Conk logo, conk.com. We're going to look at their front page in real time just before we put Morrissey on. So it's the best single news aggregator on the internet. Now Fox News carries Hot Air, and also I think all of the Salem media properties, or they're actually called Town Hall properties. Those are the six or so websites that Salem Media owned and bundled together under the Town Hall brand. In addition to Hot Air is one of the 75 or so news sources that Conk uses to construct its front page every 3 hours. So yeah, if whatever's on Hot Air ends up on Conk, so you can see it there. Anyway, we're going to check in with on the Conk front page in a few minutes. We're going to do that. Ed's on tonight. Tomorrow night, we got a guy named Albert Rosales. Now, Albert has written 15 books on what he calls humanoid creatures. These are not necessarily like aliens or extraterrestrials or anything like that. They're just shit that looks vaguely human that people see and report. And he's written 15 books going literally all the way back to the birth of Jesus. No lie, year zero. These books are chronologically ordered. They're about every 50 years or so until you get to year 2000. Now, he said in his, I've been reading his latest book, it's 2010 to 2015, so it's only a five-year period. He says in the foreword of this book that it's going to be his last one. I wrote him today with instructions on how to connect to the show, and he wrote back and he sent me the draft of what apparently, I don't think this is a book, I think it's going to be more like a report, but it picks up at 2015, we got to talk about this, I don't know what's going on here, because he's got too much stuff, and yeah, he has too much stuff. I mean, these stories are incredible. I'm sure some of them aren't true, but if any single one of them is true, I mean, my God, it's like, it's the weirdest crap. And also, I want to thank Stan Gordon, UFO researcher extraordinaire, for joining us last Thursday. We had a fantastic discussion with him. And, you know, I couldn't get him to really speculate. He's an investigator. He basically just says what he learns and what he knows, and he doesn't bother to try to extrapolate or any of that sort of stuff. But the one thing he did say several times at the end, and that is there's something really, really weird going on here. And when he means going on here, he's talking about the Bigfoot phenomena. So he basically went from researching UFOs to researching Bigfoot, and now he's basically researching them together because he, confirmed. I've heard this before, and if you watched any of our Bigfoot panels here, I'm constantly asking this question. There's many people who say they have seen a Bigfoot disappear right before their eyes. They're looking right at it, and it's gone. Like one woman, and I'd read this previously too, not this particular report, but one woman report that Stan investigated said she opened her door because she thought it was like a coyote. She's living out in Wyoming or something. That was rummaging through her stuff, and she opened her door, and there standing 6 feet away from her is a 9-foot Bigfoot. And she brought her gun out to shoot the coyote, and by impulse, she put the rifle up and shot the Bigfoot. But she said what happened was that it was like kind of like one of those, and some of you, you know, you youngins don't know what the hell I'm talking about. But one of those old flash bulbs from like an Instamatic camera kind of went off really, really bright, and the thing disappeared. It was just gone. Yeah, and I've heard these stories before, and Stannis says he's getting too many of these stories to discount them. As a matter of fact, you know, the interesting thing about my friends, I got a friend of mine who just teases the crap out of me about the Bigfoot thing. He doesn't buy it at all, not the least bit. And I, until recently, this is what I've told him, I have been pretty much on the fence to this until I talked to Larry Newman, who's coming back on next week. I'll get to that in a second. Bigfoot investigator, and I talked to Stan and these other people. We have these. I mean, I'm starting to lean toward the fact that these things are real. Now, when we had a panel on, this is about what, November or something like that. We had a panel, three people, Bigfoot investigators on with myself. Larry was one of them. And I asked them point blank, is there anything paranormal about this creature? And all three of them said no. They're convinced it's just an undiscovered primate that's out in the forest that we have not been able to catch. And that's legit. I mean, there's a very legit story. People say, well, how could we not catch it? Well, all right, try this. Giant squid were rumored to exist for 2,000 years until, what was it, 1980, they finally caught one. Finally. 2,000 years, you know. Gorillas were rumored for hundreds of years, and they didn't catch one until 1855. I thought it was 1955. I've been reporting this. I read this wrong. I was wrong about it. It's 1855. That they definitively proved that gorillas were real. But they, for hundreds of years, people have been talking about it. So it's not unusual to have something roaming around that we can't catch, that we don't know anything about, you know? But the thing is, what Stan was talking about, and Albert's talking about this too. I'm reading his book. I'm actually, and I read his part of his report he sent me today too. There's too many of these things that are too freaking weird. And, you know, when Stan ended, if you want to go back and listen to it, it's fascinating. There's unfortunately no picture of him. You get to look at me, and I don't know what it was. A friend of mine even brought this up. He said, you know, you looked pretty shitty on the TV, on the computer last night. Yeah, I did, and because I didn't know this. Not only did one of the lights in our studio fail right in the middle of the broadcast, but I forgot to turn one of them on. So the lighting was really bad, and I looked terrible. I noticed that myself. I did. But anyway, besides that, okay. So I sound like Emily Campagna on Fox News. what he ended this whole interview with is the fact that there's something really, really weird going on here that we don't seem to be able to figure out. It's beyond our realm of physics. You know, I watched a documentary. As a matter of fact, I was actually going to write Stan today and tell him about this. I don't know if you've seen it. It's called A Flash of Brilliance, Paranormal Bigfoot, on Amazon Prime this last weekend. 2-hour movie. And some of these documentaries are unbelievably bad. And the thing is, you know, what I've learned, if you want to see good ones, you got to pay for them. So this one was on sale. I think it's because I had some credits. I bought it for like $1.74. Okay, fine. If it's terrible, I'm not going to bitch about losing $2. It wasn't terrible at all. But the thing is, the premise of this movie is basically exactly what Stan was talking about. It's called Paranormal Bigfoot. There's way, way weird shit going on with these Bigfoot sightings. And the last one in the movie, the last one in the movie, which they obviously left toward the end because it's so unbelievably, it's unrealistic. But the thing is, and the guy, one of the narrators said, I would never have even come forward with this, except there's two of us who saw it. There are two guys, they're cable TV, you know, a repairman, and they're driving around in a van. I think, and if I'm right, this was in Oregon. And they're kind of out in the woods, kind of, sort of. But it's a public road. It's a, you know, highway, 2-lane highway. And they're driving, and they both saw this. They saw, first of all, they said they saw what looked like a deer standing on its hind legs that immediately morphed into a Bigfoot that then morphed into a small, like, ape-like creature orange organic orangutan type ape, and then morphed into a perfectly square thingy floating in space that darted off into the woods. It was a square, a cube. And this all happened in like seconds. But both of them saw this. So, okay, yeah, they might be making that up. Yeah, there's a lot of these people can be making this up. But Albert talks about this, and Stan talked about this too. You get reports where there's common elements to them, and a lot of these researchers, I don't even bother to ask, they don't want to talk about the common elements because they don't want people to fake them, because they can tell when, after a while, you can tell when a sighting is legit if it names one of the elements that's common to all the other sightings. Of course, none of these people know each other, you know, and that's how you can kind of sort of smell out who's faking, who's fibbing, and who's telling the truth. Anyway, well, so tomorrow, Albert Rosales is coming on. He's written 15 books on this subject, humanoid creatures, not just, like I said, not just ETs, not great aliens, ghosts, Bigfoot, all sorts of stuff. Basically, if it walks on two legs and has a head, he writes about it. So it's like a lot of books, like 15 of them, and maybe a 16th. He's written one single book out of that series called, I think it's called UFOs in Florida, and it's about UFOs in Florida. But that's the only other book he's written that's out of the, you go to Amazon, you can buy all, like, there's 14 books in a series, you can buy them all at once. I think the price was like $150 on Kindle or something like that. Okay, so that's tomorrow night, Wednesday night. Thursday night, Mark Mercell, who was named Bigfoot Hunter of the Year by the Bigfoot Times magazine, He's going to be our guest. We're going to talk to him and find out what he's got going on. I'm going to start, and then Larry Newman's coming on a Monday. Now, let me tell you what we got coming on a Monday. Monday, we're doing our first month in review panel. So there's three guys. I used to do the Conk weekend podcast on Conk News six months ago, I guess. I did it for 3 years, I think it was. And it was a panel, and we had a damn good time. And Don Zorro and Tim Conaway were always the two mainstays, and we'd always have a third guest panelist. Sometimes it was Jeff Meyer, who, you know, owns Conk News, but usually not. Usually it was some other person. But there were four of us total, including me. And the guys have said, you know, why did you? Well, first of all, they came on for the debate nights. It was the same panel, basically, except Jeff sat in, and we had a darn good time. And not only that, I don't know why this happened, and I'm thankful, thank you, but our last debate performance, debate night panel, was basically the highest ranked or watch show in this series so far where we didn't have a major guest. I mean, we've had guests have come on, and because of their social media platforms, we've had several thousand viewers for those shows. This is it was the highest watch show that we've had where we did not have a guest plugging it via social media, and I don't know why it was that one. I really don't, but it was significant. Our viewership was significantly higher than our first average show, like me going off on Monologue Monday with nobody around. So anyway, the guys are saying, you know, it's like old times. How can we do this again? And I stopped to think about it. I thought, well, you know, we could do this once a month. And also, they're busy now. I mean, we were doing that. Conaway and Zara were showing up pretty much every week. It was a weekly show. And so I thought, well, let's do this once a month. So we're basically in the band back together, and Larry Newman is going to be the third chair, and he was often the third chair there too at Conk News. So he's going to be joining us, and my point is I'm going to start bothering these Bigfoot people about this paranormal stuff, because I know a lot of them just don't want to buy it. They don't even want to go there, and I understand they don't want to go there because the public, they're having a hard enough time selling Bigfoot to the public just as an animal, let alone something that can, you know, like my friend says, well, the experts say it can change planes. Oh, and he's laughing his ass off. Yeah, you know, right, that's the problem. You start talking about this shit, You know, but I don't know. I've been saying this for a long time, folks, and that is I'm convinced that there's something going on the planet Earth that we humans are completely unaware of. And because of that, I don't know what it is. I don't. But I have the feeling, I have this strange feeling something's going on here in our world that we don't even, that we're walking through or something. And for some reason, we can't discern it. If you want to know about dimensions, according to string theory, there's 11 dimensions in our universe, and we can only perceive 4 of them. So, and the thing is, we might be able to come up with machines that can conceive, that can sense them. We never will. As humans, we never will ever. We're just not wired to do it. So, okay, so yeah, so that's what we got. We got Albert Rosales tomorrow. We got Mark Marcel Thursday. We got the month in review panel. That's Conaway Zorro and Newman on Monday. Next Tuesday, I'm taking the whole week off. I'm taking the rest of that week off. We're coming back on Tuesday night, February 6th. So, and I'm not just going on vacation. I got work to do for this show. So, and maybe sometime I'll explain that to you later. Text us tonight if you want. You can text us now in real time. I got the little monitor over here where we get the little texty things. It's wonderful. 408-458-5088. That's 408-458-5088. And me staring at the ceiling when I'm trying to go to bed at night. I finally realized the reason that number is so easy to remember, it's 10 digits, but there's only actually 4 numbers. 4, 5, 0, and 8. That's it. I got a 10-digit phone number that's made up of only 4 actual numbers. Who would have thought it, huh? Okay, so I told you about how I think Nikki's become addicted to attention. This happened this last weekend. Maybe you've heard about this. I find this really amazing. Sports Illustrated has fired its entire staff. They've laid them all off. It appears that that magazine is going to fold. Now, if you know it, I mean, 50 years ago, it was the shits. I mean, it's like, you know, if you were into sports at all, it was just fantastic reading. And then they started that swimsuit issue. And then it's like, oh, my God, look at these women. And say, like, and this magazine was going gangbusters till about maybe, what, 10, 15 years ago. Well, two things happened. One, they're wrapped into one thing. The damn magazine went woke. And then that swimsuit issue. Look, here's the deal. I don't really give a fuck if you think I'm prejudiced or biased or bigoted here or not. I'm not going to, if you're a trans woman and you want to be in Sports Illustrated, I'm not going to lust after you because there's no way, conventional way I can have sex with you. You understand that? Now, Jim Norton, the comedian, he is married to a trans woman. Okay, now maybe, I guess they figured that out, you know? I don't know what's going on there. I don't know what they're doing. But no, I'm sorry. I'm a straight man, and I don't want you in the pictures in this magazine because I'm not going to lust after you. Because as soon as I find out that you're not a real woman, the bets are off, okay? So, and I don't think I'm abnormal in that regard. So you want to stick trans women in bikinis in your magazine? You go right ahead. I'm not going to buy it. Fuck you. I don't have any trouble if you want to live like a woman. I really don't. I don't have any trouble with that at all. But if you want me to lust after you, go fuck yourself. And of course, there's an oxymoron there, but yeah, all right. No, that's not going to happen. You know, so okay. And then on top of that, then it turns out about 6-8 weeks ago, they revealed that they were using AI to write stories. And of course, the stories were bad because, you know, what we haven't figured out yet, everyone's saying, well, AI is going to take jobs and eventually it will. But right now, AI is pretty fucking shitty. You know, it plagiarizes and it makes shit up. And it's like, yeah, it doesn't do a very good job. It's not a very good writer. You know, I'm talking like ChatGPT in particular here. And we should talk to Jazz Shaw about that because he writes about that constantly for Salem Media. He's always on there. He's got a subscription to the thing. So, you know, it's like, it's not very good. So, yeah, you want AI to write your damn articles? Yeah, they're not going to be very good. And actually, seriously, what does AI know about women's basketball? All it knows about is what it reads about on Wikipedia. You know, it's like, oh God. So at any rate, yeah, the whole thing's folding up. It looks like it will be not. They won't be able to resuscitate it. It's going into bankruptcy. They've, for the time being, they've laid off all the staff, all of it. They're not putting out issues anymore. I guess they're still planning on putting out the swimsuit issue because it was already in production. It usually comes out, excuse me a second, in early March, I think it is. But there's more news over the weekend, and this you probably did not hear about. The LA Times laid off 117 journalists over the weekend. That's 20% of their entire staff. Now, last year, they laid off 25% of their staff, which was, you know, John Nolte said in Breitbart, you do some quick math, in one year, they've laid off a third of their staff. Why? Because they're losing $40 million a year. The owner says, in reality, they're losing about $1 million a week. And he is right, the guy, I can't remember the guy's name, I can't pronounce it, it's a Korean, and he's a biotech billionaire. But he's literally writing $1 million check every week to keep the LA Times afloat. He's personally writing this, $1 million a week, because they're not making any money. And you know why? Because they're woke as hell, too. No, people are not buying the paper. And speaking of that, okay, the Washington Post, they're losing $100 million a year, and their subscriptions in the last 12 months, 25% of their subscriptions have canceled. This is coming back to bite people in the ass. Now, you could make an argument that for the Washington Post and the LA Times, if you're going to write about politics and your constituency is largely liberal, that might not be a bad idea per se to put in the woke. Sports Illustrated, no. No, nobody wants this. All I want to do is see the fucking game. I want to see the fucking game. I want to see the girls in the bikinis. That's all I want to see. Okay, it's like that stupid shit they're putting at the end of the end zones in the NFL. Cut that crap out right now. That's bullshit. I do not care. Well, and even if I do care, and even if I agree, I don't want to see it during the goddamn game. I just want to watch the game. That's all I want to do. You know. Also, I'm not there to see Taylor Swift. It doesn't necessarily bother me that they're going to put her on camera, but I'm not there to see her. I'm there to watch the freaking game. You know, and if Taylor Swift is getting people to watch the NFL, well, in some ways I could say, well, good for the NFL, but these people aren't going to come back. As soon as Taylor's gone, they're going to leave. They don't know, you know. So I don't know if it really helps anything or whatever, but the fact is we're there to watch the game. The game is the entertainment. The game is escapism, and we don't have enough escapist entertainment in America right now. This is a problem. I've come to the conclusion this is even one of the reasons that the popularity of porn is increasing, because porn is escapist entertainment. It is. You're not thinking about anything except who the pizza guy's delivering the pizza to and what's going to happen next. That's all you're thinking about. There's nothing you know, intellectual going on here. And people want that. People are tired of thinking about their jobs. They're tired of thinking about their relationships, all that sort of crap. Just let me watch something where I don't have to think. And football is fucking perfect for that. You know, I mean, I was a football player in my youth. I was pretty damn good. And I have to say my obsession with football has waned in my older years. The last 10, 15 years, I'm not as into it as I was before I was 50. I was really into it. But still, I still like watching it. And in some ways, it's a perfect game because there is a certain amount of chess moves regarding offensive plays and stuff like that. So there's a certain amount of thinking involved, and yet it's highly, highly physical. I don't have to tell you that, you know. Any rate. So one more thing. So Mark Simone, who's on WOR 770 AM, he's a talk show host in New York City. He thinks he was in Barrett News Media today, which is a radio media specific trade publication. And he said he thinks that in the next 12 months, before the end of the year, both the New York Post and the New York Times will stop publishing their printed editions. Now, I've been asking everybody that I've known for quite a while when this is going to happen, because I think I will outlive this, or this, I will, this will, well, how do I put this? I will die before this happens. That's what I think. Now, according to Simone, the Post, he didn't give the statistics for the Times, but the Post has 80,000 print subscribers. These are the actual printed newspaper, you know, the pulp newspaper, and 3.5 million web subscribers. And that would be about right. You know, yeah, there, I know not a lot of people read the printed paper anymore. And he said it's basically only for senior citizens that can't figure out the internet. That's probably true. But 80,000 people is still a reasonably good number, especially when you consider the fact that no one's ever been able to figure this out. Print advertising in newspapers seems to be, it still is, very effective. I mean, you will get a return on your investment. You run an ad in the paper, and I'm not talking about classified ads, I'm talking about display ads. You run a display ad in the newspaper for your business, and people will call and they will show up. They do. It doesn't work online at all. As a matter of fact, this is one of the things that this article is actually about, is the failure of online display advertising. And it is. It's a complete failure. Nobody clicks on it. Nobody looks at it. I mean, it does not work at all. And so the idea is you have to go to subscriptions. Now, I'm an old dude. I go back. I was working on the web 1.0 in the late 1990s. My friend, I ran a huge website, one of the largest websites in America in the 1990s. I'm not going to name it. So what I still remember, there was some guy, and I can't remember his name now, and I wanted to remember. I was just having a conversation with a friend of mine about this a couple days ago about the idea in the 1990s is that information should be free. There's some guy, some evangelist, he was a programmer. He was going on and on and on. He was everywhere about the fact that information should be free. You're going to put your newspaper online, it should be free. Nobody should have to pay for anything. Well, you know, so my business partner at the website I was running, and he says to me very famously, and he was a computer programmer, he says to me, "Yeah, Jim, you know, here's what I think. My programming will be free when groceries are free." And he's right. That's it's crap. But every single newspaper in America abided by this, except the Wall Street Journal. The Wall Street Journal went online in 1998 and said, "You want to read the news with the Wall Street Journal online? You better fucking pay up, bucko." And they were charging like $120 a year. And everybody thought they were ridiculous. It was, no one's going to pay for they put the whole newspaper online. The Wall Street Journal has been behind a paywall the entirety of its existence. So it would be about 35 years now online. And they were the only people that got this right. They have made money hand over fist online doing this. Everyone else had to come back and kind of like fix the airplane in midair. Well, because so the point of this article is that online advertising doesn't work. Simply doesn't. But because the print advertising still works, I'm very dubious by his prediction. But he said this. He thinks that by the end of the year, they will both start printing. Now, you have to understand, printing a newspaper is an unbelievably ridiculously complex undertaking. It really is. It's like the fact that that anybody ever made money at it, I find amazing. You know, it's like I've talked about this before. Up until about 70 or 75, roughly, I don't know where exactly, when offset printing became a big deal, they were making type out of lead that they did every day. They would lay out lines of type out of lead. They had a machine that actually typed it in the lead, and then they would stack the lead in the presses and run the thing, and then when they were done with that day's edition, they would take all that lead and melt it down, and the next day they did it all again. Now, that isn't maybe a good description of that, and I just did that in like 25 words in 20 seconds, but you stop and think about how hard that process is. It's ridiculous. It's absolutely ridiculous. Yes, and yet they perfected this to the point where they could make money at it, and you know, charging a buck a paper, whatever it was. You know, well, in 1970, a newspaper was probably a quarter, maybe then. But at any rate, the fact is, the mainstream media is going to hell. That's what's happening, and it's mostly their own fault. I even have to bring this up too. Craigslist, you know, killed the classified advertising business for newspapers in America. And I remember there were people, the publisher of the San Francisco Chronicle called Craig Newmark, the guy who started Craigslist, a communist, because Craigslist was almost entirely free. And I don't know, I haven't followed this for a few years. I don't know what they're doing now. But, you know, they were the big classified ad provider on the internet for many, many years. And I do know that this is going back maybe 20 years ago now. So you're probably about 2010 or 20, even 2020. I don't think they did have more than 30 employees. And they were making, and they made money this way. This is how Craigslist makes money. All the ads are free, all of them, except for employment ads, which they charged, at least for then they were charging only in five cities, like New York, all the, you know, L.A., Chicago's. If you want to place an employment ad, you had to pay. And that, because they had such huge, enormous viewership, because everything else was free, and including placing an ad was free, they made money. They were, I think even 20 years ago, they were making, their revenues were about $400 or $500 million a year. I mean, Craig Newmark is a really, really rich man. And the thing is, we're not talking about stock market margins or any of that sort of crap. It's cash. That cash ended up in his bank account. So, I mean, he has made, I'm sure he's a billionaire at this point. No doubt about it. I mean, he was personally making $100 million a year. This is 10, 15 years ago. So anyway, you know, the mainstream media, my point is they're dying, and it's their own damn fault. They should have, somebody at some newspaper somewhere should have thought of what Craigslist became. I mean, they were selling classified ads. You're doing it. You know, how come it never occurred to you? Well, maybe we put all of them online for free except for one category. Oh, geez. Oh, that won't work. Oh, yeah. And the irony thing is it gets back to the thing, information should be free. Well, whatever. That's bullshit, but that's where we're at now. So there you go, folks. I'm bringing that up. So we're going to look at the Conk front page right now. Here it is. Man, I still have problems with this. We have a little bug in the system here. There we go. So I pulled this out about an hour ago, roughly about 20 minutes before we went live here. So the interesting thing is, and this is from the New York Post, I think, because the New York Post does not have a logo on the bottom. And you can't see, I'm flowing around my cursor. You can't see it. What the hell? What am I doing? Do I need to, you know, seriously, take me out behind the barn and shoot me. Anyway, interesting article here in the middle from the Post, the top front center. Barack Obama's deferral means he could be Harvard's next president. So that story is about the fact that I looked at it when I put the page up. It's about the fact that Harvard University has offered the presidency of Harvard to Barack Obama, and he didn't necessarily turn it down. He said he was going to, basically said he was going to think about it, which everyone seems to think means he's going to do it. So that's really interesting right there. And then on the left-hand side, you got Trump cruises to victory against Haley in New Hampshire, and which we talked about. At any rate, all these stories, including these editorial cartoons, all of them, update on Conk News every 3 hours. So you come out, well, yeah, what it's like, it's 10:41 Central Time here. You come back at 2 o'clock in the morning, and this will all be different. I don't know in the middle of the night if it changes that much, but definitely changes during the day. I can tell you that. If you go out there, you go to Conk at news at 10 a.m. at 2 p.m. It's completely different. Totally, it's a news junkie's delight. No freaking lie. That's Conk.com, Conk.com. So we're gonna run our interview with Ed Morrissey now. And you guys want to stick around for this? It's very cool. We had a fantastic conversation. I got a couple things afterwards that will be kind of interesting, I'd like to think. So anyway, let's do this. Oh, hold on. I got 12 seconds of bumper music. Watch this. joining us from his home in Central Texas, Ed Morrissey. Hey, Ed, are you the managing editor or editor-in-chief of HotAir.com?
I'm now the managing editor of HotAir.com. I became the managing editor a couple of years ago. We never had one before. The term editor-in-chief probably more likely would apply to our senior vice president of Town Hall Media. So, but I'm the managing editor. I'm the guy that runs it on a daily basis.
And so I was just talking about this before we started recording here. You used to live in Minneapolis.
I did. I lived in the Twin Cities. I lived in Eagan, actually. So just south of St. Paul. Yeah.
Right.
23 years.
Right. And now you're in Texas, and now I'm envious. So.
Well, you know, Central Texas is really nice. It's very green, and it's rainy today. It's been cold here. I mean, they actually do get winter here in Central Texas, which was a little bit of a shock. But
you get snow?
Yeah, we actually got snow a couple of weeks ago, and it didn't stick, though. Just it comes down and it disappears. The ground doesn't get cold enough for it.
I was in Miami in January 1977, the only day in recorded history it snowed there. A quarter of an inch at 5 o'clock in the morning. The city went nuts.
You know, when I was a kid, I grew up in Southern California, grew up just outside of Los Angeles. And every few years you get what they called snow. Basically, it was ice hail.
Yeah.
It would just accumulate and evaporate by the afternoon. But you know, when you're a kid and you grow up in Southern California, that's snow.
Yeah.
It qualifies.
Yeah. I lived there for 5 years. I never saw any. So, you know, but that's me. So, hey, let's I was going to ask you, you know, the New Hampshire primary is going on right now as we speak. There's no results yet, but let's go to your background. How did you get into journalism or whatever it is you call what you do?
I used to run call centers, right? And I wanted to be more active as a writer. I always wanted to be a writer. And you know, I had a very nice career. I really enjoyed my work. But I decided to take up blogging because I thought it would give me some discipline as a writer. It would require me to write every day and et cetera. And I just loved it so much. And the commentary, you know, it was pretty much an open market back then. And a lot of people were reading what I wrote.
When is back then?
Fall of 2003.
Uh-huh.
So just a little over 20 years ago. And I got picked up by Hugh Hewitt on Salem Radio, and then, you know, connected up with a lot of really great bloggers back in the day. And, you know, actually people who were in the liberal blogosphere too, because it was sort of almost a brotherhood back then. It's more of business now, which is good, benefited me. But back then it was just sort of a hobbyist brotherhood. And it was always kind of fun to see people succeed out of that, regardless of what, you know, side of the aisle they were on. Those days are long gone, but that was sort of the ethos back then, and it was a fun time to be you know, in the market for that.
Yeah. You know, I've been I have people on from Hot Air all the time, you know, and other Salem Media properties too. I'm not really necessarily shilling for you people, but my God, you got a really, really talented stable there. It's like, that's pretty incredible.
Got a great team. And you know, the nice thing is they're all friends. And so my job as a managing editor is really pretty easy in that respect. Everybody's there who wants to be there, who loves to write, who loves to be part of the mix. And all I'm doing is basically scheduling and working on the headlines. I primarily do the headlines now. So
yeah, that's good for you. Hey, I didn't actually ask you. So what brought you to Minnesota?
Well, it was a job. Actually, it was a call center job. I'd had a small gap of employment, and there was a call center in my field where the opening came up to manage it. And a headhunter found me and got me to move out of Southern California with my family to Minnesota. I really enjoyed it. I like living in Minnesota. And that was a good job. I actually really enjoyed the job too. It was for a good company. I worked there almost 10 years and became their national director of, you know, Berg Fire Alarm Monitoring. And it was a good job too. But after a few years of doing this as a hobby, I decided that I really wanted to do it for a living. And so almost 17 years ago now, I decided to leave the comfort of that corner of corporate America and do this for a living, and eventually ended up at Hot Air.
Yeah, I've been living here in Minneapolis for about 30 years now, and other than the weather, it's fantastic.
It is.
The weather is awful.
Yeah, the weather is primarily what moved us out of, because people down here said, why did you move out of Minnesota? I said 23 Minnesota winters. And when, you're there in your late 30s, early 40s, it's great. When you're pushing 60, it isn't. And, yes. And if you have other options, and this job is extremely portable, you tend to start looking for those. We had some other mobility issues. And then one of the interesting things about that, and you know this, is that for efficiency purposes, houses in Minnesota go straight up, right? So you have multiple levels because it's a lot easier to heat and cool houses that are built like that.
Yeah.
But we got to a certain, my wife and I got to a certain point where we had some mobility issues and we really needed single level living. And in the Twin Cities, that basically means you're going to be living in an apartment. And I didn't want to live in an apartment.
Yeah.
And we wanted to be out of the ice and cold weather and all that kind of stuff. So we came down to Central Texas, took a look around, decided that we wanted to give it a shot. And we found a really nice community down here.
That's very cool. Good for you. Good for you. Okay, let's go on to the New Hampshire primary. So you wrote a couple days ago that DeSantis's exit was not really about him, or him running in 2024 was not really about him. You want to explain that?
Well, I mean, certainly his decision to run in 2024 was about Ron DeSantis. I'm talking about the results in the Iowa caucus and clearly what we're now seeing in polling across the entire primary schedule. This has been what I've concluded that this is really a referendum on Donald Trump's incumbency. Does the Republican Party want Donald Trump as their incumbent nominee? Because that's kind of what he is. It's an unusual situation we have. I haven't seen it since the late 1890s. I guess maybe early 1900s when Teddy Roosevelt ran on the Bull Moose ticket. Or do they want to change directions? Either change directions policy-wise or just change directions leadership-wise? And the answer has been, no, they want to stay the course. They want Donald Trump as an incumbent. So it's not even really, Ron DeSantis could have run a flawless campaign. It's clear now, based on what we've seen over the last several months, that Republicans really just want Donald Trump as their incumbent nominee. And that's what they're going to get. And, we haven't seen any results except for Dixville Notch.
Yeah,
New Hampshire, right? The 6 votes in Dixville Notch.
I watched it live at midnight.
Good for you. I was in bed.
Yeah,
I was in bed, and it was nice. Let me tell you, it was really nice.
I believe it.
but I have no doubt that what we're going to find today is another big Trump win. The polls are showing this, and as we discovered in Iowa, the polls have been pretty predictive. In this cycle, the pollsters have actually done a pretty good job in giving us predictive results. And the gaps in New Hampshire are just really large. So I can't imagine that there's some sort of untapped silent Nikki voting block that's going to come out in New Hampshire today. I mean, it's certainly possible. I'm interested in what the results are going to be. But I think if Donald Trump scores another double digit win here, especially if it's, 22 points, which is what the latest Boston Globe Suffolk poll shows in New Hampshire. I don't see how this primary continues in any sort of competitive basis whatsoever. I mean, I think that at that point, the cat's out of the bag, right?
Yeah. Hey, Ed, forgive me if you actually said, how long have you been the managing editor of Hot Air?
Yeah, I've been managing editor for a couple of years now, a little over 2 years. Prior to that, we didn't really have a managing editor. It was sort of a collaborative effort between myself and Ala Pundit, who's now over at the Dispatch.
Yeah.
As Nick Catoggio, that's his real name. And he and I would just agree to do things in a particular manner. But he left to go to the Dispatch, and Town Hall Media really wanted somebody to take charge of strategic direction with Hot Air. And
the reason I'm asking is you brought up the polls. What happened in 2016? How come the polls were so wrong?
Well, I think that there's a problem with polling, and it's gotten worse, which is that people have stopped answering pollster telephone calls.
Yeah.
And so what's happened is the people who actually answer these calls and finish the surveys all the way to the end are people who probably really want to participate in these polls. That's not really a good sampling strategy. Now, the pollsters don't really have any other choice because they have to find people who are actually willing to talk to them in order to do anything. But I think what happened in 2016 was that they weren't very good at trying to get more people to answer these calls. Now, I think they got better because 2020, the results were closer, right? Yeah. And even in 2016, they weren't off by a lot, but they were off by some in those really key states, the blue wall states, Wisconsin, right. Michigan, and Pennsylvania. And I think that I think it's gotten better. For some reason, the polling seems to be getting a little closer to predictive in each cycle that we've gone through. And so whatever the adjustments they've made seems to be working at the moment. But, you know, they're just tools. And you have to look at them broadly. And you can't look at any one specific and say that's what the result's going to be.
I don't know the answer to this question. What adjustments have they made? Do you know?
I think that they may. I think a couple pollsters talked about shortening their surveys so that they don't get people that fall out in the middle of them. Uh-huh. You know, so just short and sweet, to the point. Question A, question B, question C, thank you very much. Some of these surveys go on for like 15 minutes and people get frustrated and they hang up and then you lose all of that data because it requires, you know, a poll requires each person, each respondent to fully, you know, finish the survey. So I think that they're asking the questions a little differently. I think that they are looking at different ways to open up that will engage people. But I mean, a lot of people just don't answer the phones anymore. They just see an unknown number and they just refuse to answer it. I'm that way.
Yeah.
I don't want to answer polls. I don't want to participate in polls because I analyze them. And it feels like kind of, you know, feels a little weird dirty. To analyze. Yeah. A little, just feel a little dirty about this. I feel like I've somehow, you know, messed up the whole thing if I do that. So
no, I'm with you. I feel the same way. I don't want to deal with it either. It's like it's for some reason it's like stepping a boundary, but it isn't, I suppose. But
I don't think it is, but it just feels weird, right?
It does. That's right. I totally agree. So you know, I talk to David Strom regularly. He's your associate.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
Well, and he lives in town here too. You know,
he's a good friend of mine. We've known each other for like 20-something years. So yeah,
he's a great guy. But, you know, he's not particularly fond of Trump personally, but, you know, he likes Trump as a candidate. How do you, you were just talking about, you know, about the fact that maybe we're nominating somebody that people don't necessarily like per se, even though they like the policies. Where are you on that?
Well, I voted for Trump twice, right?
I did too.
I don't like the guy. I have never liked Donald Trump. I don't know how else to put this. He was the worst of the two alternatives. And actually, I was enthusiastic about voting for him in 2020. So I should amend this somewhat. But in 2016, uh-huh. I really had to convince myself to actually even cast a ballot. And the only reason I did, and this was in Minnesota where Hillary Clinton won the state anyway, was to just in some way keep Hillary Clinton from becoming president. I was more enthusiastic in 2020. It's like, yeah, no, let's give this guy a second term. He's done a pretty good job with the first term. And then the whole post-election thing happened. And I got to tell you, it's not, I'm back to 2016. It's like, man, I'm going to have to really be convinced to vote for this guy again. And Joe Biden might be as good an argument as there is to do so. And Kamala Harris too, because she'll end up being president the next term if they win.
Right. Well, so, do you think there was an insurrection on January 6th?
No. I think there was a riot, and I think that was embarrassing. And I think that the entire, you know, post-election challenge to the point where it departed from actual, you know, statutory and regulatory challenges to elections, because we have plenty of opportunities. You know, a well-financed campaign has plenty of opportunities to challenge results. Right? They can ask for recounts. And they did that. I have no problem with that. I think Jill Stein asking for a recount after 2016 was clearly a way to, you know, white knight for Hillary Clinton. And we made a lot of fun of that, right? Oh, yeah, Jill Stein might have won this. Might have won Michigan. Yeah, I don't think so. But it's certainly legal. It's within the prescribed boundaries. It's the tools that candidates have to do that. But Donald Trump went well beyond that. And in ways that I think are dangerous if they become a precedent. So I don't think it was an insurrection. He wasn't trying to, nobody was armed. How do you have an insurrection without an
I know. You know, that's what I think too.
It was a riot. Right. It was a riot. Right. It was, and he behaved badly, during it. He refused to, for a while, he refused to go out and tell people to knock it off. I mean, it just, I have problems with that. And I have problems with the stuff that he did even prior to that. But, you know, these, we've got two choices here. We got Donald Trump or Joe Biden. Unless you have some sort of black swan event in the meantime. And, you know, you got two guys, you know, got one guy's going to be 78 this year. Got another guy's going to be 82 this year. Something could happen.
Yeah.
But as it looks right now, we're going to have a choice between Donald Trump and Joe Biden. And Joe Biden is a complete disaster area. Donald Trump is a partial disaster area. You know, that's kind of where I'm landing. And I'm not happy to be landing there. I think that we had better options. And I wish that incumbency referendum had come up with a different result. But I can wish all day. And it's not going to change anything.
I'm impressed with Trump's ability to get stuff done. I don't know a single person, you tell me otherwise, I don't know a single person who supports him who actually doesn't have any problem, who has no problems with his character. I don't. Not a single person.
Oh, there's a few, I suppose. You know, you see, they're the loudest voices out there, usually on social media, and there's a couple in regular media that think that he's the greatest thing since sliced bread in every way, shape, or form, and any criticism is somehow an attack on America. There are people out there who actually think that way, but I don't think it's, I don't think that that's significantly an issue. I think that, again, I just think that most people would have liked, I can't even say that, because most people in the Republican Party didn't want to change in direction. There were a number of people who really did.
Right.
And I think, and I wrote this about a year ago, the first party that comes up with a new candidate is going to win the presidency. And well, I still think that would have been true.
What about Nikki Haley then? What is her? She is kind of being painted as like an old style Rhino Republican candidate. I don't know if that's actually totally accurate or not. But do you think she's being painted that way? Or
I mean, she's definitely being painted that way. I don't know that I think it's entirely accurate either. But she's kind of aligned herself with this sort of northeastern moderate Republicanism that's really out of vogue. I mean, it really is. Even to align yourself sort of to the, you know, the pre-2008 GOP establishment, you know, the George W. I love George W. Bush. I thought he did a good job as president. But that mentality, right, that early, you know, the 20 years ago Republicanism, it's simply not in vogue these days. Voters don't want that. Voters think that those people screwed them over.
Yeah.
And they want somebody who is going to pay attention to them. There was a really good piece by Selena Zito. I don't know if you've ever talked to Selena. She's terrific.
I haven't.
You should try to get her on your show because she's great.
Okay, I will.
And she wrote a piece yesterday that said the Donald Trump train started with the derailment in East Palestine, Ohio.
Uh-huh.
Joe Biden never showed up out there. Donald Trump did.
Yeah.
That's the difference. Is that Joe Biden was too busy to deal with the people of East Palestine, and Donald Trump actually showed up and met them and walked through the town and talked with them about their problems, and that's the difference. I think George W. Bush, by the way, would have gone to East Palestine. I think he would.
I do too. Absolutely.
But this is why you have such a huge populist impulse on both sides and both parties. Is that voters, especially blue-collar voters, think that their party has abandoned them. Their party's establishments have abandoned them. And Donald Trump, multi-billionaire that he is, you know, guy who gilded his entire New York, you know, penthouse.
The bathroom,
speaks
right.
Speaks to them. Yeah, speaks to them on that. He connects with them on that. And the elites hate that. But for whatever reason, he connects with them very well, and they are very loyal to him.
I got to ask you, though. Because I'd be dying to ask him this question personally. Why do you think he's the richest person who's ever been president, and yet he does seem to connect with the average blue collar voter? Why?
I think his personality is closer to them than it is to the people that he's around, and it's kind of Donald Trump anyway. You know, Donald Trump, his entire adult career, if you will, and it's going back to the 80s. It's always been about flash. It's always been about pugnaciousness. It's always been about, you know, me, me, me. Mm-hmm. It's one of the reasons why I never really liked the guy. But it's always about sort of taking the elites down a little bit, taking him down a peg. And I think that people respond to that. I think that that's what people, aspirationally, that's what a lot of the blue collar working class Americans want to do to the elites that are trying to tell them how to live their lives, is they want them taken down a peg. And Donald Trump succeeds at doing that. You can't underestimate the impact that that has on their loyalties.
You know, Newt Gingrich says something to the effect that, I'm paraphrasing here, but he said that Donald Trump I knew even 10 years ago could never have been president ever, but he's changed. Which I found kind of interesting. All right, fine.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think the Donald Trump that started evolving around 2000, 2002, 2003, that's the guy we're seeing right now. The Donald Trump pre-2000 wanted to be with the Clintons, wanted to hang out with all the all the cool kids, have his picture. You know, they weren't doing selfies back in those days, but he would have been the guy with the selfie, taking his picture with all these people and saying, you know, look how important I am.
Right.
Yeah.
You wrote a piece a couple days ago. You've been writing about the Fannie Willis debacle. Oh, this is, I've been reading about this. And so, Ed, tell me, how could somebody be so fucking stupid? What the hell is she thinking? I mean, well, I don't.
You know, if the genders were reversed, we would say that Fannie let the little head do the thinking for the big head. I mean, this is something guys talk about, right?
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
You let the little head do the thinking. Yeah. This is where it gets you.
My little head's done a lot of thinking. It's saying, I'm glad it stopped. I'm 68. It stopped finally.
Well, good for you. I'm almost 61, and I'm kind of hoping that it stops running in my life too.
But, it stopped.
I mean, that's, you know, what was I have a quip that comes up in times like this is, oh, what a tangled web we weave when first we practice to conceive. And,
I got to remember that. I'm going to use that. Thank you.
Well, I borrowed it from Will Shakespeare. I'll ask Will, okay. But I'm sure he'll let
That's
you use
fine.
It. Fine. But this is, I mean, it's a grift. And this is a delicious story. It's a lot of fun. I don't know if the court's going to kick her off the case. If she is forced to come off that case, I don't think there's another prosecutor that put together the RICO case.
No,
because that RICO case is ridiculous.
It is totally
some of the charges in there are legit, right? I mean, the hack into Cobb County. I mean, certainly the people who are involved in that can defend themselves on that, and maybe they can, you know, keep the government from convicting them on those things. But the idea that this is a RICO case is absurd, and only a political hack would have tried to put it together this way. And only a political hack would have hired her boyfriend of the moment and shoveled $650,000 cash so that she could go on vacations with him on the money.
But here's the amazing thing. She charged Mrs. Wade, or she attempted to charge her with obstruction.
Yeah. That's actually a big deal, and I haven't seen a lot of people talking about that. But she threatened to charge her. She threatened to charge her with obstruction for attempting to subpoena her in her divorce, in Mrs. Wade's divorce process, because apparently, Willis had something to do with Mr. Wade as part of that divorce process, and then she lied, or at least Jocelyn Wade's attorneys say she actually lied about what happened in the marriage, and she did that publicly. They called it false and libelous that Jocelyn Wade had an affair before Nathan Wade did. I mean, Fannie Willis is an idiot.
Yeah.
She's been kicked off another case before, by the way, too.
Right. For conflict of interest. You wrote that in that piece. That's right. Yeah. I didn't know that. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. She right now she looks like an idiot because none of this was really necessary.
No,
it was.
That's the amazing thing. It's like it's all her doing. You know, I mean, I hate to say this. She's always struck me as just some stupid two-bit bureaucrat. You know, I mean, it's like who's been trying to. I mean, I can't imagine.
I think you're right.
Yeah,
I think that's accurate. That's the problem.
You tell me. Did she actually think this RICO thing was going to stand? I just assume she was going to take this to a re-election and said, well, okay, I tried, you know, that would be good enough for her constituents. And, you know, and she would ride off into the sunset, even though this wasn't going to work. There's no way in hell she thought this would actually work. Do you think?
I am not sure. I have no insight into that. She's certainly acted as though it's going to work. And the media has been behind her on this. You know, there's been very few people in the media who've actually stood up and said, this is not what Georgia's RICO statutes actually are, you know, apply to. There have been a few who say, look, this doesn't fit within Georgia's RICO statutes. And when it comes down to trial, she may have trouble sustaining this. But she got, what, 3 or 4 plea deals out of this?
Yeah.
Mostly on the charges that were the easiest to prove.
Right.
And none of which had involved the RICO predicate. So I don't know if she really thought that she could succeed on this. I kind of think that I would just guess that, yes, I think she really did think that she could get convictions on this, but it's a dumb case. And as soon as this gets assigned to a prosecutor that knows what they're doing. And I think one key thing about this is Michael Isikoff, and I can't think of the other person who wrote a book about this, just came out maybe about 3 weeks ago, reported in the book that Fannie Willis had actually offered the job to 2 other prosecutors who had RICO prosecution experience, and both of them turned it down. Now they're saying, well, it was going to be too much work, blah, blah, blah. You bill, if you're an attorney, you bill right. hours yeah. based on right. work. So right. I don't think too much work is really the issue no. here. I think those guys, the people that she approached looked at that and said, this is not a RICO case, and decided that they didn't really want to be involved in it. And that's yeah. when she, if the book is accurate, that's when she brought in her boyfriend, who was clearly willing to do it, and bill a ton of hours for it too.
So Ed, let me ask you, what happens? You're talking about those charges. What happened with Sidney Powell? This woman had a sterling reputation until she started talking about the Kraken, and the whole thing it all kind of completely blew up. And I don't understand her motivation. I mean, it seems in retrospect that she obviously lied, but I don't understand why she would. I mean,
yeah, she kind of admitted to lying, right? I mean, that yeah. was part of her plea bargain.
Right. 30 years yeah. of a sterling reputation and just kind of up in smoke. I mean, do you have
any I think that's what happens when you buy too much into a single person as a political figure. You know, not to get too serious, because I enjoy the lighthearted repartee that we've got here.
No, but please.
I've always found Psalm 146, verse 3, to be a guiding principle if you're going to do anything in politics, which is put not your trust in princes. And it goes on from there, but put not your trust in princes. And I think that that's a warning that you should really pay more attention to principle than to, you know, personalities. And I think that that's where a number of people have gone off the rails, and not just with Trump, right? I mean, we saw this with Barack Obama. We've seen it with, you know, other, you know, the Clintons to a certain extent, although I don't think they ever had a cult of personality as much as Obama did or Trump does. I think that when you get that far off of your core, you do and say dumb things, and you make very bad decisions. And so Psalm 146, verse 3, to me is the reminder that don't get too caught up in one person. Remember who you are and what you're supposed to be doing. And even if you're not a believer, if you're not a Christian or Judeo-Christian, it's still really good advice. Because other people will lead you down the primrose path. And all you got to do is look at Sidney Powell or Rudy Giuliani or some of the other people who have, you know, been sort of led down that path by blind, willfully blind service to Donald Trump.
You write a column on Sundays called Sunday Reflections, and I'm glad you kind of brought this up because this was on my list here. That's often based in biblical scripture, or I guess that's an oxymoron. Maybe not. Maybe it isn't. Maybe
There's all sorts of different scriptures. you know, I mean, it's a Bhagavad Gita. I don't know anything about it, but I know it's there.
But do you think America's in a spiritual crisis?
Yes, I think the whole world's in a spiritual crisis, and I think it's always been in a spiritual crisis, but it really is a lot more so now than it has been in the past. And by the way, thank you for bringing up the Sunday Reflections. Of all the things I do at Hot Air, that's the, it doesn't get a ton of traffic, but it's the one thing that I get the most reaction to when I meet people who read the site, is that they almost always bring up the Sunday Reflections. And the Sunday Reflections are based on the readings in, you know, I'm Catholic, so it's the readings for the Catholic Church. And at the bottom, I always say, this is part of my preparation for Mass, is to actually, you know, read these things and think them through. And I've been doing them for 11 years now, I think, or 12 years. It's something in that range. And I just feel really called to doing that. But I do think that we're in a spiritual crisis. And I think that when you see, I think when people are so relentlessly secular in their approach, you fall victims to the fads and the cults of personality and the, you know, the social panics and everything else like that. You lose perspective. And I think when we're disconnected from our history, and scripture is definitely a key part of that history, it's not the only thing, but it's a key part of that history, of, especially in Western civilization, I think you lose perspective even further. And I think that that's part of what we're seeing here, is that we've really lost our sense of civilizational history and civilizational legacy, of which the, you know, the Judeo-Christian scriptures are, you know, a huge component of that.
Let me segue to the Israeli-Hamas war. So I personally, and I, based on your writings, I'm assuming you kind of agree with this. I don't understand how anybody at this point could hold Israel or kind of responsible for what's happening. I just don't. I mean, they got bombed, you know, on October 7th, completely out of nowhere. They haven't had anything to do with Gaza in about 14 years, whatever it is. And all of a sudden, there's a whole bunch of people in the West, not just in the United States, but in the West, that actually think that, you know, that Israel's kind of partly or all responsible for this.
Yeah.
Oh, Jesus, this is terrible. Now I forgot my question.
Well, we're talking about how you can hold Israel responsible for this. Yeah. And yeah, I mean, so I agree. And I think it goes deeper than that, because Hamas and Gazans have always been at war with Israel from the time that Israel left in 2005 and Hamas took over in late 2006 after the elections, the only elections that they've ever had there.
Yeah.
They have been firing missiles and rockets into Israel constantly.
Yeah.
For, what is it, 16, 17 years now. And the only reason you don't hear about it is because Israel spent a huge amount of money to build an anti-missile system called Iron Dome, which we produce, you know, a lot of the components for here in the United States, and they're able to intercept almost all of them.
Yeah.
So they don't kill anybody with this.
Right.
But those are dumb missiles that are just slung at Israel's population centers with the intention of killing a lot of Israeli civilians. And nobody ever comments on that, right? Nobody ever says Hamas needs to stop doing that before there's any discussion of, you know, a two-state solution. There shouldn't be a discussion of a two-state solution. Hamas doesn't want a two-state solution. They've made that extremely clear.
And that was actually my question.
Yeah.
Even in the last few days, they reiterated again, we don't want a two-state solution. We want to destroy Israel. I mean, they're completely straight up admitting it. They're not even trying to hide it anymore. So what is with American leftists and the leftists in Europe, and how can you, like, nothing is funnier to me than queers for Palestine. Yeah. You want to be a queer in Palestine, they'll throw you off a roof. You know, it's like, how do people wrap their minds around, what's the justification in the human psyche to do this?
Well, in the West, we have unfortunately adopted the Marxist-Leninist structure of oppressed versus oppressors. Right. And that's the way people see the entirety of human existence, is that the entirety of human existence is the oppressors versus the oppressed. And they have decided that the Israelis are the oppressors, in part because Israelis look more white than the Palestinians do.
Yeah.
And even that's sort of a, you know, it's a rough distinction, because almost half of Israelis are Mizrahi Jews. It's close to half or just under half. Meaning that they came from the Middle East. They are Jews from the Middle East. Some of their families have lived in Judea continuously, right?
Yeah.
Judea and Samaria. Others were expelled out of other Middle Eastern cities and other Middle Eastern countries, and they came to Israel because that's the only place that they could have refuge. So even that is dicey. Even the skin color thing is dicey, but that's the way that the left, and it's not just the left either, by the way. It's some people on the right see it that way as well.
You're right. You're right. I should have, I signed it correct.
No. I mean, on our side, we say the left an awful lot, but there's some people on the right that feel this way as well. And it's entirely wrong. The Jews have been in Judea for thousands of years. And then somebody actually had something really funny, interesting to say, which is that there's only one people in the world that are still living on the same plot of land that they were on 3,000 years ago, still worshiping the same God and still operating off the same scriptures as 3,000 years ago, and it's the Jews of Israel. They're the only ones. The Arabs didn't even get, the Palestinians are Arabs, and the Arabs didn't even get there until around the 5th or 6th century AD, right?
Yeah.
And prior to the British Mandate, which is part of the Palestinian argument, which was supposedly illegitimate, the Arabs weren't in charge then either. It was the Turks of the Ottoman Empire that were in charge, and the Arabs weren't really all that present there at that time either. So, I mean, this whole nonsense of oppressors versus oppressed is, I don't know how you get to a point in life where you think that the Jews are oppressors rather than oppressed.
Oh, I know.
Especially over the last 100 years, right?
Nothing's funnier than calling a Jew a Nazi.
Right, or an oppressor. I mean, the United Nations, I mean, this is supposed to be the paragon of liberal thought. The United Nations certified Israel as an independent nation in 1947 on specific borders. And the borders were based on where the Jews were living as opposed to where the Arabs were living. And what did the Arabs do? They invaded Israel from every direction, trying to destroy it just as soon as its independence was announced. And Israel defeated them. And they've done it. They did it a couple more times. And finally, in 1967, the Israelis seized a bunch of the land that they were using to attack Israel. Because if you ever look at the 1947 borders, man, it's like this thin in the middle. You know, it was extremely precarious existence for them. They finally just seized land to, for strategic purposes as part of dealing with constant invasions by the Arabs. The only oppressors here are the other Arab nations who created this situation and then refused to give the Palestinians, which is a name that was made up in the early 1960s for these Arab refugees, refused to give them sanctuary or to take them in. So they ended up, aggregating in Gaza and in the West Bank.
I go back to Bill Clinton's thing with Yitzhak Rabin and Yasser Arafat in December 2000. That's when I realized that there was never going to be a two-state solution, when basically Rabin and Clinton gave Arafat everything he wanted for all practical purposes. And Clinton has said in retrospect, he said it was obvious now. He said he didn't figure out then that the reason Arafat said no is because he realized, well, if he solved the problem, he would be out of a job. Like, personally, they don't want to solve the problem.
I mean, you're right, Jim. And about 3 years ago, 3.5 years ago, Prince Bandar of Saudi Arabia went on Saudi television to give his accounting of the last 40 years or so of the Saudis trying to help the Palestinians come to a solution for their state. And it's very much, from the Saudi point of view, that he does not like the Israelis. He's got lots of bad things to say about the Israelis. But what he says is that basically Arafat and the Palestinians stab the Saudis in the back every single time they've tried to help them out. And the Saudi royal family is simply tired of them. And this was in, I think, August of 2020. I did write about it. It's all in Arabic, but it has English. The video has English subtitles. It's two videos. They're each about 30 minutes long. The second video is the one that really has the recounting of that history. And it is very much well worth watching. because it's as close to the truth as you're going to get about what the Palestinians have done and how they basically continued to create this situation, because they're simply not going to be satisfied with statehood under their present in their present location. They want from the river to the sea has a very specific and literal meaning. And it doesn't matter if they're Fatah or Hamas, they both want the same thing, the complete elimination of Israel.
Is that the reason that the Arab or the Abraham Accords were or are working? Is that they were just got fed up with the whole thing?
Yeah, I think that was, first off, that was a Trump initiative too. Remember, yeah,
right. That's why I brought it up.
And the Saudis were supportive of it. They wanted to be last, right? They didn't want to be the last country to line up with that. And they're really the last ones yet to do so. And they're holding off now because of the war, which was part of the reason why Hamas launched the war, because it was just going to be a matter of weeks before the Saudis and Israelis normalized relations when the war started. But yeah, I think what they were trying to do is what the Saudis wanted was they wanted to force the Palestinians to recognize reality, and that the only thing that they were going to get was the land that they're presently on.
Yeah.
And they were hoping that by uniting the Sunni nations in normalizing relations with Israel, that the Palestinians would take the hint. But part of this too is the fact that Iran has been trying an encirclement strategy around the Sunni nations. You've got Syria, and you've got Hezbollah in Lebanon on the western side, Hamas on the western side. You've got the Houthis in Yemen, and it was on the southern side of Saudi Arabia. The Iranians want to use these proxies to control the Middle East and eventually to take control of Mecca and Medina. They want to kick the Saudis out. That's their long-term goal. And the Saudis know this. And what they're trying to do is they're trying to break this encirclement strategy, which is one of the reasons why they're not going to be terribly unhappy to see Hamas destroyed. It's not going to play well with their subjects in the kingdom. And they know that, which is the reason why they're vociferously demanding that, you know, Israel come to some sort of two-state solution thing too. I mean, because that's for domestic consumption, but they don't want to have they don't want Hamas to have statehood any more than Israel does. Hamas is a threat to the Saudis. The Houthis are a threat to the Saudis. Hezbollah is a threat to the Saudis, and they all know it.
So I've heard this. You know, it's hard to look at the Biden policy and the Obama policy against Iran and try to have a WTF moment, like what the hell, you know. But so I've read this thing that supposedly the point of this whole deal, that Obama's point and now Biden's too, is to empower Iran so that Iran and Israel are more or less equal in this region, and it would basically be a mutual, like, self-destruction thing. Is there any truth to this? Or it doesn't make any sense to me at all. It just seems like
I think that would be the outcome of it, right? But I don't think that was the intent. Just to get the Americans out of it. Was to reduce American involvement around the world. The leftists under Obama, and that means also under Biden too, because it's basically Obama's third term going on
right now, right? Yeah,
only with less competency. Is that American influence anywhere it's at is evil, and their prescription is to withdraw America, to make America equal among nations, and not be, you know, that their influence is strictly, you know, diplomatic, and that's it, because anything else is illegitimate. And the problem with that is that you're going to end up with a lot of wars at the end of this, and this is a really good demonstration of exactly what's going to happen the more that American influence wanes.
So where are we on Ukraine too? I have to be honest, on my show, I don't talk about it very much because I honestly don't know what to think. This is the two things. On the one hand, we get to fight Russia by proxy. On the other hand, it just seems like we're starting another endless war that just benefits the military industrial complex. And isn't it amazing that Eisenhower, of all people, got on TV and said that? I mean, a 5-star general.
It's like, yeah, you know, I think there was good reasons for that. I'll say this about Ukraine, is that it's not really our war. right? It's, and the reason why we need to support Ukraine in this, there's a couple of reasons. Regardless of what kind of government that Ukraine has, it is still, it was a sovereign nation, and it, its sovereignty was guaranteed by the United States in the deal that we cut with them and Russia to give up their nukes, right? In 1991, we were very afraid of all of these different former Soviet republics having their own nukes, and we were going around and guaranteeing their sovereignty if they would give up the nukes. And Ukraine was a big time part of that. The very specific purpose of that was to keep Russia from invading Ukraine. Russia has been invading Ukraine since 2014, right? I mean, 2022 was an outright full-on invasion without any provocation whatsoever. They were, before that, in 2014, they were fomenting, ethnic rivalries in order to have an excuse to go in and, but I mean, 2022, it's just they're flat out, they're just going to send armies in and roll over Ukraine and seize it.
Right.
And you can't have imperial conquest become the norm again, because that's how you get world wars. Because eventually you're going to have to stop it. Because once Russia got a taste of that, they were going to keep rolling into the Baltics, because there's a substantial Russian minorities there. Moldova, which is a disputed region, part of Moldova is a disputed region. I forget the name of the disputed region. And Ukraine is the entryway for all of those places, Poland even. And you simply can't allow that to happen. That's part of what the post-World War II order that we were trying to set up is to put an end to wars of imperial conquest. And that's what Russia's launched. And that's what needs to be opposed. And I don't care if you like or dislike Zelensky. I don't care if you think that the Ukrainian government is corrupt. We guaranteed their sovereignty. It was an elected government. We guaranteed their sovereignty in exchange for taking away their nukes. And we really should be helping them to resist a foreign invasion in a war of conquest. It's what needs to happen. And certainly we can talk about keeping better track of the money. Certainly we can talk about keeping better track of the weaponry. We can ask for, I don't know what you call it, some markers as to when, when things are going to happen and stuff like that. But it's war. I mean, you can't just say, well, we're going to recapture the Donbass and, in summer of 2024. You don't know that that's going to happen until you actually do it. And I think that there is a impatience in American foreign policy that if we don't see something happen within 6 months, that it's never going to happen. This is not something that you can be impatient with. The Ukrainians have been valiantly resisting this Russian invasion. I think that's actually going to get worse in the next summer, this coming up summer, because Russia is going to mobilize a few hundred thousand more soldiers and they're going to throw them into the front lines. We just can't let Russia. We can't just let Russia, conquer independent, sovereign countries and look away, because it's really bad. It'll be Central Asia next, and there's all sorts of implications for that too.
Ed, you explained that as well as anybody I've ever heard. Thank you. Seriously, you actually kind of like changed. It's not so much that you changed my mind. Like I said, I haven't known what to think. I've been, like most people, I've been avoiding it. So, all right. Hey, I want to thank you for doing this. I probably kept you too long here. What's going
on? My pleasure.
What's going to happen in hot air in the near future?
Today we're, as we're recording, I'm not sure when you're going to put this up, but we have a new co-host for our Off the Beaten Path VIP show. Christian Toto of Hollywood and Toto has joined us as a contributor for that members only podcast. And so our first episode with Christian drops today. We're going to be covering the New Hampshire primary live results. We've got, we work with Decision Desk headquarters to embed the live results thing. And so that'll go live just at the time that the polls close, along with some commentary from me. Otherwise, we're going to keep doing the things we're doing. You know, we're definitely going to keep an eye on that Fannie Willis case, because that's the most fun story of the year so far.
Absolutely. No, we're going to be putting this up at 11 p.m. Eastern. So, okay. You know, we do our show live on Mondays and Thursdays, but because it's so late, I offer to record these. So, you know.
Well, so, yeah. I'm in bed at that time, as we just got done discussing. So yeah.
And I'm not. Yakka, yakka, yakka. Hey, and also just really quick, I do belong to the VIP thing, and I will encourage. I'll make a little plug for you. People should do this too. You have a fantastic publication. It's a go-to thing for me every single day. So, you know, it's like, and also all the town hall properties, but yours in particular, just seems to shine to me. So,
well, I appreciate that. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. And thank you for your membership.
Thank you. You're welcome. You're welcome. And I hope we can do this again sometime. Thanks.
Absolutely.
You take care. We'll see ya. That's Ed Morrissey. He's a not editor-in-chief. He's a managing editor of HotAir.com, a Salem Media property, one of the six town hall properties owned by Salem Media. And I promised him I'd do this, and I guess I did already do it, but I'll do it again. You won't be wasting your money if you buy a VIP membership there. They have two versions. You can buy a VIP membership just to hotair.com, and you can buy one that covers all the town hall properties, all six websites, which is the one I have, because I need to do a lot of research. And actually, I wasn't kidding. Hotair, I mean, this is the third guy I've interviewed from Hotair, and the other two come on a regular basis. So I check out Hotair every day, every single day. Now, he also, I've read Selena Zito's articles too, and I'm going to try to get her on also. That was a good suggestion. I'm glad that he suggested that. So I got a couple more things here before we go tonight. I kind of alluded to this in the show description on Rumble and YouTube. I want to show you something here. I got a picture queued up. One moment. Okay, so take a look at this woman, right? She's not real. They've named her Lexi Love. She's completely AI generated. That picture is generated by computer. That is not a real photograph. I do want to point out, because I'm a perv, although I am. I have spent some time looking at this under a microscope. I'm astonished by how incredible accurate that or realistic that picture is. I mean, you can't see it at this distance, but there are flaws in her skin, believe it or not. She's not perfect, that look completely realistic as to a real person. So the deal is, I don't have the link actually, and I want to give it to you anyway because I don't want you to become a perv too. You can sign up to make Lexi your real or fake AI girlfriend. And I don't know how much they charge, but right now she's making $30,000 a month. She makes more money than you. And she will cater to your needs as much as she can through a computer screen, which is not a lot actually right now. But anyway, yeah. And she's quite attractive. I think I have another picture here too. Let's put that one up. Hold on a second, because I know you want to know. I know you do. This one isn't quite as big, but I got her. There we go. There she is again. That's her. Yeah, so this is the future, man. So you're not going to be able, you won't be mating anymore because you won't be able to. I don't know what's going on. I just like, this is nuts to me. I mean, porn is one thing, okay? And, you know, all right, you know, I mean, let's be blunt. It's a masturbatory aid. That's what it is, you know. And I guess maybe in some ways this is too, although this woman, I mean, she will text you on a regular basis. I'm calling her she. She's a computer programmer, a computer program. She's not a programmer. She's a program. If that turns your crank, I guess that's okay. But you know, it's you gotta for a guy who's been married 34 years, and I had some reasonable girlfriends before that. You know, the wonderful thing about the relationship, it's great at the beginning. And then after 30 years of marriage, you start to realize, oh my God, apparently somebody's noticed that I have flaws. Who would have thought that? And also, then, you know, if you have any self-awareness whatsoever, you start to realize, too, I'm really annoying. And you think my wife loves the fact that I do this on the inner tube? Because I'm not, usually, before I was doing this, I was talking to her. So it's like, yeah, she said, yeah, just sit down and shut up. It's like, I don't want to hear about the UFOs. But I really don't know, seriously. It's not a real relationship. I've had this problem, and if you think I'm changing the subject here, I'm not. This is my problem with televangelists. Now, I've been in broadcasting as at least a side job my entire adult life, 40, 45 years. I've done all sorts of stuff. The reason I hate televangelists so much is because they have, I'm talking about televangelists defined as ministers, evangelists on television. Got that? Because they set up what is essentially a false relationship with the viewer. The viewer thinks they know the televangelist, and maybe they do, but the televangelist doesn't know the viewer at all. And they fake this relationship to give the viewer the idea that they know them. And that's exactly what's going on here, you know? And so I personally think that it's a fake relationship, and you have a fake girlfriend, and no, you're not having sex with her. I'll just be blunt here. There's no penetration going to happen here ever, because this isn't real, okay? But I don't know. This is the way things are going. And right now, I mean, every survey I've seen said that especially young people, and young men in particular, seem to be extremely more socially awkward than they were previous generations. And that's because they don't have any practice meeting any people, because they're on their phones, and their phones should be thrown away. And so now you're wondering why I don't do social media, and I don't. And probably if I was on social media posting, we'd probably have more people watching the show. And right now, I don't care. Maybe I'll change my mind in the future, but I don't want to go there. I just don't. And finally, another piece of news here that I wanted to make you aware of, and that is they were almost going to tear down the house that Marilyn Monroe died in August 1962. It was her own home. It was the only home she ever owned. Obviously she had homes, but, you know, she either rented them or lived with her husbands or whatever. It's the only home she ever actually owned in the Brentwood area of Los Angeles. And I lived in Los Angeles for 5 years. I never saw this house. I did see a lot of stuff, I got to tell you, because I'm an obsessive history freak, and I basically spent every weekend for the 5 years I lived in Los Angeles driving around looking at obscure shit. So like, I saw Marilyn Monroe's grave in the middle of the night, too. I mean, I think I've talked about that previously. Actually, we busted, a bunch of us, we were drinking, and we busted into the cemetery that's in Westwood. And we saw her crypt. It was there. But she died in this house. It's always been kind of mysterious. It's known for a fact that Robert Kennedy showed up at the house a few hours after she was pronounced dead. There was a long-standing rumor that he was having a long affair with her. It's kind of never really been definitively laid out. She people say she had an affair with John F. Kennedy. She might have slept with him once or twice, but other than that, they did not really have an ongoing relationship. I mean, there's one time, apparently, where they both spent the night at Frank Sinatra's house, and there's a possibility that, especially knowing Jack, that they had sex at that time. So, and maybe one other time too, but those are the only two times they've actually been known to have been together, even other than that goofy birthday party where she's saying happy birthday. But she supposedly did have a long running relationship with Robert F. Kennedy. And the neighbor said he showed up at the house a few hours after they found her dead. There's also, it's not conjecture, but there's people who say that, and this gets kind of weird, that she died on the way to the hospital, but her handlers and the people who knew her, they didn't want her dead dying at the hospital, so they literally turned the ambulance around and brought her back home. She died in the ambulance, apparently, and they brought her back home and set the crime scene up because the investigators, the inspectors who came to actually see her body said the crime scene looked like it was staged. That's what they said. They said that right. The two detectives said that they noticed that right away. They were experienced, and they said, yeah, it looked like somebody set this up. But so there's always been this rumor that she was murdered, but apparently the likely story is that she died in the ambulance and they did not want her pronounced dead in the hospital. So they turned around and brought her back home. That's who knows. But at any rate, this house is a very nice house. Because of the looky-loos over the years, the current owners, it's private now. It is a real home still. Have built a wall around the house, so you can't really see the house anymore from the road. You could previously. And the new owners were going to tear it down and build another house. And I think it's the Los Angeles Conservancy. They do a lot of that historical stuff. I think they got the hold on it. And it looks like now there's a possibility that... I think the plan right now is they're going to move the house. So the owners can build on the land, but they're going to move the house and make it a museum or something like that. That's what they're kind of planning. But at any rate, the house was saved for the time being. Anyway, I just find that because I'm into any sort of weird historical crap, if you listen to the show before, you know how much this all fascinates me. So once again, we've been posting long shows lately. My goal is to keep them to 90 minutes. This one's about 105. Matter of fact, the last two are about 105, too. I want to thank you for hanging in there. I thought our talk with Ed Morrissey, I thought was just fascinating. The stuff he said about the Israel-Hamas war and the Ukraine war, I thought, man, you can't get better commentary or interpretation than that. That's my feeling. I'm hoping he wants to come back. So tomorrow night, Albert Rosales is going to talk about humanoid creatures. He's cataloged thousands of them. Thousands. He has a database, and he's written 14, 15 books on this subject. So we're looking forward to talking to him. Good night, Esperanza. Good night, Uncle Donnie. And good night to you, wherever you are. Thanks for watching, everybody. I'll see you tomorrow night.